And Becca was saying that every time I give a talk here, she's always on to some fundraiser. All for a really, really, really good cause. It does remind me of the story of the barman here in Melbourne. He used to belong to, I thought he still does, belong to one of those bikie gangs. This really big guy with lots of tattoos. And in his nightclub, there was a standing contest. Once he squeezed a lemon of all the juice to put in somebody's drink, if anybody else could take that lemon and squeeze three more drops out of it, they could get free drink. And all these football players, these weightlifters, these really big, strong laborers on work sites, they would try the contest and they could hardly ever squeeze anything out. At most, only one drop. And then one evening, this lady came in and she said, "I'll give it a try." I said, "You can't, all these big guys, they can't squeeze anything out of the lemon." I said, "Oh, let me have a try." And they and so the barman, he took the lemon and squeezed it all out for the drink for somebody else. And he gave the lemon to this girl. And this girl took the lemon and started squeezing it. 1, 2, 3, 7 drops came out of that lemon. And my goodness, even these big guys can't do that. And you're a woman, you're not very strong. How can you do that? And she said, "Oh, because I work on the fundraising committee of the BSB." I couldn't resist that impression. Well, okay, be generous. Come on, you've got a lot of juice left in your liver, so you can't take it with you. Don't give it to your kids. You give it to your kids, leave it to your kids, you spoil them. They don't have to go to work themselves. So do a good cause like the BSV Monastery Committee. Monastery Project, yeah, which is coming up soon. So, it's amazing I'm here back again. I was only here again last May, it's only a couple of months ago. It's amazing what the BSV will do to try and get me here. They're arranging this change of the constitution just as an excuse to get me to give another talk on something or other. But, of course, it's very wonderful to be able to give a talk on the Dharma, to inspire people, to make people happy, and also to solve many of the problems in life. And of course, I'm really happy to see the BSV just change over those years, get bigger and bigger and stronger, and see even Buddhism getting stronger throughout our world, at least the world I go and visit, which is wonderful to see. And it's because the power of these teachings are amazing. We were talking earlier that sometimes that in some places there are too many rituals. And because there's too many rituals, people can't get to the heart of these Buddhist teachings. Now, even like the bowing ritual. Do you know why people bow in Buddhism, as people explained that to you before? It is actually to make sure your tummy muscles get well exercised so you don't lose weight. But if we know why we bow, then it's very easy to understand why we do that ritual. And I think I explained that last May when I was here. Now I bow to virtue, peace and compassion when I bow. And I remember those things because to me that's what a Buddhist statue stands for. So every time I put my head down, first of all, I'm worshipping virtue. Because it's very important. The fact that you're a good person and you're trustworthy. It's wonderful to be a person other people can trust. I still remember when I was a very young monk, one of my old school friends came to visit me in Thailand. And I said, one of the most enjoyable things when you come to stay in a monastery in Thailand is to come on the morning alms route. It's really early in the morning, the weather's nice and cool, and you see all this inspiring faith of all the lay Buddhists who get up very early and just put a piece of rice in the monk's bowl. It's an ancient tradition. It's a very beautiful tradition. And when I told my friend that it starts at 5:30 in the morning, he said, "Forget it." Because now Westerners, they don't get up at 5:30 in the morning. I was noticing even breakfast we had this morning. We had our breakfast at 7 o'clock and that was served by a couple of Sri Lankans, because you never find an Australian getting up at 7 a.m. on a Sunday morning. At least it's very rare. But when I said, okay, it doesn't matter, I'll wake you up. I'll come to your room and I'll knock on your door 5 minutes before we go on arms round. He said, thank you very much. And of course I did that the next morning, and as I was walking with him after the arms round, he said it was one of the strangest feelings he'd ever had in his life. Because when I said I would be there at 25 past 5 in the morning to knock on his door and wake him up, he said he knew I would be there. He could trust me. And he said, living in London, many people said they would be there and do these things, and they would never turn up. He said, because I was a monk and a good friend, he knew that he could trust me 100%. What a wonderful feeling that was for him. And that shocked me. How many people, you know, they say, yeah, they're going to be there, they're going to do something for you, and they don't turn up, they don't come. Isn't that sort of a terrible feeling inside of you? And to know that you can be trusted is a wonderful thing, which is one of the reasons why, as a monk, if I make a promise, I have to keep it. So I've been telling other people as well, you know, if you make a promise, you keep them too. Now, otherwise, it's letting other people down. It's lowering your standard of virtue. And if there is a problem, the aircraft gets delayed, or you get into your car breaks down, just call someone to tell them. But at least you're not letting them down. It's unforeseen circumstances, which means you don't get there on time. And because it's a retreat period, as you know, that the monks and the nuns go on a retreat this period, I did tell all my disciples over in Perth, and hopefully that Bhante Jag has asked you as well, please, out of respect for the Sangha during this 3 months, out of respect for everybody, please don't die during these 3 months. It's a lot of burden doing funeral services for people during the 3 months. So please don't be selfish and think of yourself and just go and die whenever you like to. Please think of the monks who will have to do all the services for you. And please put off dying until after the rage retreat is on over. So after October, you can die whenever you like. But please, so that we can have a nice, peaceful time. So the virtue is a really good thing to have, and it means that we can trust one another, which means that we can not have to worry so much. That means that I worship that in our society. And I worship peace. Peace between men and women, especially in a marriage. So please, don't argue with each other. If you are going to say anything, make sure you say some kind things to each other. They usually say you can tell how long a person's been married by how they speak to one another. The first year of marriage, it's usually the wife listens to the husband. The second year of marriage, the husband listens to the wife. And the third year of marriage, the neighbors listen to. But isn't it wonderful? You've got to live with this person. You're stuck. So you might as well make something out of it. So learn to be peaceful, to be kind. That's the third thing I've had down to, compassion. Giving people the benefit of the doubt. You don't know why your husband did that. You don't know why your wife spent so much. But that's just what wives do. That's just what husbands are like. They're all the same. So just take it on the chin. But at least you can be peaceful and kind to one another. And that's why I bow down to those three things when I sort of do these little ceremonies. But unfortunately, there's so often in Buddhism, there's so many ceremonies that we don't really understand the real teachings and why we have those ceremonies there. And even the chanting which we do. I know Pali, so when I do chanting, I know exactly what it means, and it's inspiring. But if you don't know the chanting, then you don't know what we're chanting. And it's true that I confess many times, one of the reasons why we do it in Pali so you don't understand is because we can make mistakes and you don't find out. And I did do that once. I did this I was doing a marriage, and I was doing the chanting for a marriage, and actually I was tired, and so I did the funeral chanting as well. But they're still happy married, so There's a lot of similarities between a marriage and a funeral. It's the death of your freedom, guys. You put yourself in a box called a home. You can't get out. But it's nice to have that sort of understanding that the peace, compassion, you know, gives like a happy life. And part of Buddhism, when we take away the rituals, you get to the heart of Buddhism, it means that we can learn how to create peace and harmony and look after one another in the world. It's very simple teachings. One of the stories which comes up, because you know, you all know I did the open the door of your heart number one, open the door of your heart number two. It's already ready to go, coming out at the end of this year. So that's 108 new stories. And one of those stories is like how a mousetrap killed a chicken, a pig, and a cow. Have you heard the story before?
No.
See, you, so this is just a taster for the book coming out soon. But the trailer. This is a great one. I tell this to kids, but you're all big kids anyway. Somebody once said the reason why my talks are popular is because I teach people as if they were children, and they love that. Because they can understand it for change. So, because sometimes people teach us high dharma. Yeah, it sounds very good. And you go out afterwards and say, did you understand that? No. But it was very deep. It felt a waste of time. So, how? And this is actually a very good Buddhist story. Once there were five mice who lived in a farmhouse somewhere in country Victoria. And the mice were best of friends. But they also looked after other friends. The chicken, the pig and the cow. They always looked after these. Because they were living in the house. And if they heard that the farmer wanted to have roast chicken, they would rush out and they would tell the chicken, hide! Make yourself scarce! The farmer wants to have roast chicken today. And so that meant the chicken could hide in the nooks and crannies of the farm, and the farmer's wife couldn't find her, so it meant they could go and have to eat something else. And whenever they wanted pork sausages, they'd go and tell the pig, hey pig, hi, don't make any noise, no more oints, otherwise you become sausage. So the pig would hide as well, so he could escape. And whenever they wanted a steak, they'd tell the cow, Mrs. Cow, Mrs. Cow, hi, go into another field, go in the bushes, because they're looking for you. And that meant that she survived as well. So the mice were very, very kind, and because they were a source of intelligence, they used to call them MI5, Mouse Intelligence 5, and they would help their friends. But one day, one of the mice was looking through a crack in the wall of the farmhouse, and they saw the farmer's wife get a parcel from Australia Post. And when the farmer's wife opened it, the mouse almost had a heart attack. Because inside that package was a mouse trap. And the poor mouse thought, oh my goodness, we're dead, we're toast, we're going to be killed. That's like, you know, your wife getting an electric chair in the post. Or... so this is going to execute us, they're after us. And so the mouse told his friends, what are we going to do, what are we going to do? Because it's only a matter of time. Because they usually, mice usually run around in the night time. And if they put the mouse trap in the night time, it's only probability, sooner or later, one of those mice is going to run over that trap and become dead mouse. So what can we do? They thought, let's go and ask our friends. So first of all, they went to Mrs. Chicken. Mrs. Chicken, Mrs. Chicken, there's a mouse trap in the house. They're trying to kill us. What should we do? You know what the chicken said? None of my business. A mouse trap can't kill a chicken. It's not my problem. It's your problem. Sort it out yourself. Have you ever had a friend like that? You've helped them many times. When you ask for help, no, I'm too busy. So really disappointed. So then they went to see their friend, Mr. Pig. Mr. Pig, Mr. Pig, help us. There's a mouse trap in the house. They're trying to kill us. What should we do? And Mr. Pig said, same thing. None of my problem. You ever heard of a mouse trap kill a pig? Look after yourself. I'm too busy. So at last resort, they went to see Mrs. Cow. Mrs. Cow, Mrs. Cow, they pleaded. There's a mouse trap in the house. Can't you help us? And Mrs. Cow said, well, I'll ruminate on it. Because that's what cows do, they ruminate. I'll get back to you, she said. You know what that means when I say I get back to you? That means next lifetime sometimes. So those poor mice, when they needed their friends wouldn't help them. So they just went about their business, and of course a couple of nights later, one of the mice was running in the kitchen, when suddenly, BANG! You always have to, whenever you give talks, say things like, BANG! That wakes many people up. Otherwise, I'd always fall asleep in their talks. BANG! And one of those mice got killed by the mousetrap and went straight to Mouse Heaven. Do you think mice go to heaven after they die? Is a special heaven for mice, or do they go? In Buddhism, we do have reincarnation. Do mice get reincarnated as well? Do you reckon? But do they get reincarnated as mice, or do they get reincarnated higher up the food chain as cats? What do you reckon? I'll leave that for Matthew and Jack to discuss next week. So there we go. One of the mice got killed. And all the four others, they heard the sound, and they all came out to investigate. And there they saw one of their friends, their brother, dead in a mousetrap. And they were overcome with grief. They started crying and moaning, putting their hands around each other to take turns in grief, because animals feel grief as well. True story, there was the corner of my monastery is on the bottom of the road where it meets the highway. One of our people saw a dead parrot. He'd been hit by a car. And up on the tree there was another parrot staring down. He was working at our monastery. We saw that in the early morning, a dead parrot with another parrot staring down. When he finished work that day, the two parrots were still there. The next day and the next day as well. For 3 days, the live parrot never moved. It was staring down at the dead parrot who could have only been its mate. Animals feel grief as well. So I know that parrot story. For 3 days, the parrot was grieving. It didn't move from the branch of the tree, just staring down in loss. And the parrot had obviously been its mate for many years. But anyway, the mice were grieving. And of course, the farmer's wife also heard the sound of the mousetrap. She got up to investigate with a flashlight. What did you think she saw? She saw the dead mouse in the trap, but she also saw four mice, arm in arm, crying and wailing. Have you ever seen that before? She had neither, so she fainted. And when she fainted, she hit her head on the floor. And when the farmer found his wife, she was unconscious. So straight away, he was too far away to call a doctor. So he thought, well, what can I give for my wife to get her better? And so he thought, I know what's good for healing people. Chicken soup. So where can I get chicken soup from? So she found the chicken, cut off the chicken's head, put it in a pot with some potatoes, some garlic, and made chicken soup for his wife. So that's the first way, the first animal which got killed by the mousetrap, the chicken. And even though he made lots of chicken soup for his wife, still she never got better. And all of the family and friends and people from round about came to visit their friend, the farmer's wife. And of course, if you have visitors, you have to feed them. So what can I get to feed my visitors? And the farmer thought, I know. Some nice roast pork sandwiches. So where can you get roast pork sandwiches from? Mr. Pig. So he had to cut off Mr. Pig's head and make him into roast pork to give to the visitors. So that's how the mousetrap killed the pig. No matter what all the chicken soup, the farmer's wife never recovered. She died. And so they had to have a funeral And after the funeral, what happens? You have to feed the guests again. So that's where they make some beef sandwiches for the guests. And where do the beef sandwiches come from? Mrs. Cow. And so that is how a little mousetrap killed a chicken, a pig, and a cow. Why? Because even the cow thought, how can a little mousetrap kill a cow when it actually did? So if any of your friends or colleagues ask for your help, don't ever say, it's not my problem. It can't affect me, because it does affect you. So that's what friends are there for, to help. Even if they think, not my problem. You know, building a monastery in Victoria, it's not my problem. I've already got a monastery. I've got too many monasteries already. What do I want another one for? Not my problem. Of course, it is. Everything is always our problem. So please remember that story and always help. It's just basic. It's basic compassion and kindness, especially for your friends. And when you do have kindness and compassion towards your friends, you don't say, it's none of my business. It's amazing what happens back. There is such a thing as the law of karma. And I've collected so many stories over my life of how karma works. Just one little story. There was a friend of mine, he actually came and told me this story over in Perth. Poor man, he had a divorce. It just happens these days. And having a divorce meant that he lost most of his property. He had one of his most prized possessions, you know, was his dog. Now you love a dog so much, but he had to move into a small apartment where dogs were not allowed. It was a pedigree dog, so he went on the internet, asked around, found a nice owner for his dog. Someone who also had a dog of the same breed, who didn't live so far away. She was a single woman, quite aged, but she would look after his dog. And that's actually how she got to meet this woman. And this woman, she was single, living alone, and she could not drive a car. So she said it was always difficult to go to dentist or to go to doctor. So he had his own little business. He wasn't doing that well, but you know, he could actually take time off. So he told the girl, look, the woman, if ever you need a lift, give me a call. I can take half an hour off, no problem. And that's what happened for the next 6 months. If you need to go see the doctor, she gave him a call. He took an hour off work. And he told me he actually enjoyed doing that. It was a break from his work. And you always find when you do something kind for other people that it gives you so much happiness back. It's often been shown a dollar spent, $10 for yourself or $10 helping somebody else, you get far, far, far more happiness back spending it on other people than you ever do spending it on yourself. So he decided to help her out. And one day after 6 months, she called again, I need to go into town to see my lawyer. Fine, I can take you there. So he took her to his lawyer. I'll wait down here until you're finished. He said, no, I need you to come up to witness something. You know when you have these legal documents, you have to witness them. Okay, I'll do that for you. When he went upstairs to the lawyer's office, he found what he was witnessing was the will which left him as the sole beneficiary of her considerable estate. She died about 3 months later, and he inherited millions. And he said, I never expected this. I was just being kind to someone. That's just what you do. It's not just kindness. There's something called the law of karma. And this is how it works. You do a kind act like that, and you get it back many, many times later. So if you know an old lady, especially a rich one, think of a woman. Did I tell you last time, because I was only here 2 months ago, about the story of the surgeon in the United States who did the free operation? I did, didn't I? No. No. I think some of you got really bad, but the young ones. The young ones don't get ready.
Yeah, that's like the milk and the cookies. Mm. Yeah, okay, I told that story last time. But these are amazing stories of, like, when you go back to kindness, you always get it back many, many times over. That's why. But you should never do it just to get something back, otherwise that's not good karma at all. But it just happens, if you're compassionate, it gives you instant happiness back. Even just recently, I was just coming back from Thailand, I went to Thailand about a week or two ago, and just going through the airport in Singapore, you know, I saw this Western lady. She was lying down on a bench trying to get some sleep. Because you know what it's like sometimes when you're transiting from, you know, overseas, and, you know, you try and get an hour or two sleep, because it's really tiring in an aircraft. And this lady was covering her eyes, you know, trying to sort of block the light off so she could get some sleep. And I had in my bag one of these Singapore Airlines eye shades. I just got one out and said, "Excuse me, madam, but would you like one of these?" And she looked at me and said, "This was weird. Now, who is this guy? But he's really kind." So I gave her these shades. "Oh, thank you so much." And that made my day. Not about her day, but it certainly made my day. I did something kind for someone. And have you ever that happened to you? You know, you do a small act of kindness and it gives you so much happiness, joy, and just energy up. One of the reasons I say that one of the great cures for depression in our today's world is charity. Maybe that's one of the reasons. There's many reasons for the increase in depression in today's world. But one of the reasons is people aren't charitable enough. They don't do enough community service. They don't help enough people. Whenever you go out helping somebody else, you get so much back in return. You can't get tired. It feels that you should get tired. You spend all your Sunday, all your weekend helping somebody else. You should be exhausted. You find if it's really a good cause, afterwards you get a sort of boost of energy, a boost of self-worth, and you learn so much. Service as part of, you know, religion, as part of Buddhism. To give service is a wonderful way of getting good health, happiness, friendship, good friendship, and even, I don't know how many people in my youth group over in Perth, they're always doing this, always getting married. And it's not a youth group. Do you have a youth group too? I mean, it's not a youth group, it's a dating club. That's what it ends up. But you know what it's like, you know, if you're young, you're looking for a partner. And you know, if you go to a nightclub, you don't know what you might pick up there. You know, you don't really know. It's not high quality. It's like going to a cheap supermarket. You get rubbish. But you get, you know, to this boutique, high-class elite stores, you know, which you have, you know, like, was it Louis Vuitton or Gucci? Like, you go to BSV, that's like, you know, designer men and young men and young women. All designed by Bhante Jag, quality control. So, you know, you pick up a nice girl, a nice boy here, you know, it's quality control, it's very good value for money. That's why people do that. Because, you know, people keep precepts. You can trust people, as I said. At least you should be able to. So by that way, that, you know, that doing service has many, many benefits. And I still remember that when I was at Cambridge, a student. You know how hard you have to work as a student? Like going to parties and other stuff. That's what it was like in those days, in the 60s and 70s. I really feel for students these days. They have to work so hard. We never used to work that hard in those days. But we had lots of parties, but I had a couple of friends. I was a Buddhist even when I was a student. And, of course, you know, you always had your other friends. There was one friend who was a very strong Christian. We had great arguments together. Not sort of aggressive, but, you know, just to find out about how we both felt about our religions. That's what friends are there for, to argue and to have great debates. But once he told me that him and a few of his Christian friends had volunteered to work in the local hospital, football hospital outside of Cambridge, for the mentally disabled. They're doing that as social services, what Christians are supposed to do. Now Christians are very good at that. Are Buddhists good at that? They should be. So I put my hand up and said, okay, if the Christians are going to do it, I'm going to do it too. Can I come as well? And it's just keeping up with the Joneses, that's what it was, just pride. So I went there, and okay, this is actually, I'm not just blowing my own trumpet or just showing the superiority of Buddhism, but you know, those guys, they all dropped out after 2 or 3 weeks. And I went there for 2 years. Never missed a Thursday afternoon. I think it was Thursday afternoon, could have been Wednesday. Now, reallocated my supervisions and tutorials so I could always keep that afternoon free. And I went there for 2 years, and I didn't do that just to be a goody-goody. I really enjoyed it. I looked forward to it every afternoon. And I learned so much. The place where I went was the occupational therapy for Down syndrome, people with Down syndrome. In those days, they were mostly institutionalized. And I was surprised. I got to know these people really, really well. And they got to know me almost better than I knew myself. Because sometimes I would arrive there, you know, on a Wednesday afternoon, and straight away they'd see that, you know, I busted up with my girlfriend. And they would notice that straight away, they'd give me a big hug. And I couldn't believe their emotional intelligence. Now, they could not speak in a very clear way. They weren't as good at theoretical physicists and physics as some of these professors which I listened to. But as far as the emotional world were concerned, they were so articulate, so sensitive. And I think to this day, if I have any degree of emotional intelligence, and I can actually relate to people, I really think it's because of those friends of mine I met in the Down syndrome ward at Fulbright Hospital outside of Cambridge. They taught me that. How to actually to feel, get to know my emotions, because they could pick it up straight away. That's what I learned. I thought I was doing community service. What did I get in the end? I got sort of some of the best education I ever did at Cambridge. No, from the hospital. Now, of course, I think you can probably relate to that, what you have learned, whatever you've served and given to somebody else. Even small things, like cleaning up after the meal on a Sunday. You know, it's amazing just the amount of happiness you get afterwards. And it's very true, there's that story. Remember the five fingers, which is the most important finger? Okay, some of you say no, but it's a great story. If you've heard it before, old and oldie, I'm going to play it again. Once there were five fingers, and they were arguing who is the most important finger. And this finger said, I am the most important finger. I am the opposable thumb. Other animals don't have that. This allowed the human race to develop, being able to hold and grasp things. And is the means for our superiority in the world. And also, not only am I the opposable thumb, the fattest and strongest, because fat is good. And we talked about that the other day with Ajahn Sujata, because if you are got this part over here is a bit heavy, it means that whenever you nod in meditation, you don't fall over because you don't fall over. But when the center of gravity is lower, it's much more stable than meditation. So those of you who have trouble nodding in meditation, please put on more weight. The weight's in the bottom. It's far more stable. You always look at the positive side of things. Don't be so negative. So anyway, I am the most important. And also I am the okay finger. You say okay? Me. I'm the okay finger. And then this finger said, no. I am the most important finger. I am the finger of wisdom. I point things out to people. That's why it's called the index finger. And also it says, you know, if you say number one, which finger do you put up? Me, number one. And if you want to know my power, just pull me up the other way and see how people react. So I am the most powerful, number one, the finger of wisdom. And this one said, no, I am the most powerful. I am the tallest of you all, so I can see further. And also, in Buddhism, we respect the middle way. I am the middle way finger, the most important in Buddhism.
the tallest, seen further. Therefore, I am the most important figure. And that left this fourth finger and said, no. I am the most important figure because I am the finger of love. When you get engaged, I receive the engagement ring, the ring of love. When you get married, I also receive the wedding ring. I'm the finger of love. And okay, you know, being able to say okay and be able to do things, be able to point things out to people, being tall and being in the middle, isn't the case that love is more important than anything else in the whole world? So I'm the most important finger because love conquers all, and I am the finger of love. And that left this little fellow. And he said, I'm sorry guys, I am the most important finger. More important than all of you. Even though you use me to do dirty things, because I'm the only finger which fits in here. Even though I do dirty things like cleaning out your ear, still, when you worship the Buddha, I am always closest to the Buddha. So those of you who do dirty things in the temple, like cleaning up the dishes afterwards, putting the rubbish out, yeah, you do the dirtiest of things, and you may be small, not as important as the committee members or the Sangha or the other people who are just so important in this temple. Still, you may be the smallest and do the dirty work, but you will always be closest to the Buddha. So there's a lovely little story that to tell you. See me in the house, tell your husband, do you want to be close to the Buddha? Take out the garbage. So that's just like being compassionate and kind. You get so much happiness back out of that. Okay, now, sometimes people say, oh, you should be talking about meditation, be talking about the meaning of life. This is the meaning of life. Finding it out in very simple things, with acts of compassion like that, you're not thinking of yourself anymore. It's selflessness. That is why it is the people with big egos, the people who say, my meditation is better than your meditation. My Buddhist society is better than your Buddhist society. Na. My type of Buddhism is more superior than your type of Buddhism. Doesn't that make a lot of nonsense? That is just pride. Even there's one fellow, he was a drunkard, but he said some wise things as well. Now Chogyam, he used to point out what they call spiritual materialism. You know what spiritual materialism is? You know, say, my temple is better than your temple. My teacher is wiser than your teacher. My meditation is more superior than your type of meditation. You can see that's what people do in the world. No. And what degree have you got? Or like those four ladies over in, what's the coffee strip over in Melbourne called?
I've never been.
It took me there once. It's a big street in Carlton somewhere. Ligon Street, that's it. Ligon Street. There's four ladies in Ligon Street having a cup of coffee. And one of them said, I'm so proud. Last weekend, my son was ordained as a Catholic priest. He said, now, when women see him, sort of they kneel down and says Father to him. I'm so proud of him. And the second lady put down her latte and said, that's nothing. My son ordained as a priest years ago. Now he's a bishop. When he comes into the room, the ladies, they kneel down, they kiss his ring, and they call him Your Grace. My Lord. My Lord, I'm not Catholic. Your Grace. Is it Grace or My Lord?
Oh, My Lord in the Anglican Church.
Anglican, okay. But anyway, I think Grace, I'm not quite sure, whatever. They call him Lord or Grace. And the third lady, she put her cup of cappuccino down and she said, that's nothing. My son was a bishop years ago. Now he's the cardinal. When he comes into the room, the ladies have to kneel on the floor, not on one leg, on both legs. And they bow their head and they call my son, Your Eminence. And then the fourth lady, she carried on drinking her coffee for a really long time. When she put it down, said, "That is nothing. That is nothing. My son, he's 6'4" tall, blonde haired, blue eyed. He plays for Essendon Football Club. He's filthy rich. When he comes into a room, all the girls pour on the floor and say, 'Oh my God.'" Okay, you get that. I say that joke because sometimes we do that in religion as well. "Now my God's bigger than your God." Now that sort of stuff is just no place. Compassion and kindness and just a bit of giving other people the benefit of the doubt and learning actually how to respect one another. That's part of religion. So these are sorts of things. When we actually put it into practice, it's actually beautiful to see. An example of that, I went years and years and years ago. I was invited by a common friend. I met him at the Cancer Support Association. I think he had a bout with cancer, so he got interested in this. He was actually a chaplain at one of the top Christian schools, Anglican schools, over in Perth. And he said, "You know, he heard me talk. That's really good stuff. Can you come to my school and give a talk at the morning assembly?" I said, "Yeah, sure, I'll do that. Because I'll do anything. Anything weird and strange, I'm up for." Because now, I've been a monk almost 40 years now, 30 years in Australia, and I've been giving talks at the BSP and giving talks at these places. Anything weird, like I gave a keynote address at the World Computer Conference last couple of years ago, and of course, bloody Jagmeet, I know nothing about computers. You know, very minimal. But the idea of me giving a keynote address at the World Computer Conference in Bristol, on some kind of actually nothing about, that appeals to me. So of course I went on ahead and did that one. That's actually very popular. Now it's still the two people who organise that, they keep on seeing me and say, "Well, can you come back again?" I mean, it's so weird, isn't it? I don't know what it is. Now if I know nothing about it, you know, and actually can speak. I don't know what these people who really do speak. And they don't know anything about it, I'm sure, probably. But anyway, so yeah, I'll do a talk at morning assembly. So I rocked up at the school very early, you know, in time for the assembly. And, you know, I was met by the chaplain. He introduced me to the principal. He said, "We have to wait outside the big chapel, beautiful chapel, overlooking the river, wonderful views. A really top private school. So we have to wait outside until all the children become settled. And once they're settled, you know, we'll get the room. We come in procession, you know, for respecting, you know, the chaplain and the visitor and the principal. And all the children will get up and stand up. And then the two of us," he said, "will bow to the Christian shrine because it's a Christian school." And he said, "You're a Buddhist monk, you don't need to bow." And that's where I found my opportunity to teach them some Buddhism. I told them, to the principal, I said, "What do you mean I'm not allowed to bow? I demand my right to bow to your shrine of Jesus." And he was quite shocked. "What are you talking about?" And I said, "Look, I can always see something, you know, in that religious figure, something I can respect. And that's what I'm going to bow to. I don't agree totally with what, you know, Jesus Christ taught, otherwise I'd be a Christian. I can see plenty in there I can respect, and I ask your permission to bow to that." And of course he understood and was very impressed, and so the three of us bowed. About a year later he came to Bodhinyana Monastery as a Christian, as a principal, and he bowed to the Buddhist shrine. He learned. Even though you're not a Buddhist, doesn't matter, can't you see something in that statue worth bowing to? Of course you can. And that's what we're doing. We're worshipping the virtue, the peace, the compassion, the generosity, the service that these people do. That's what we have statues there for. That gives it meaning. which means not empty rituals anymore. Something we do, and we're reminding ourselves of the beautiful qualities of these people. And it also straight away creates a sense of harmony and tolerance between our great religions. Yeah, there's a lot of things we don't like in other religions, but there's a lot of things we can like. And then you can translate that into how to live with your husband and how to live with your wife. Yeah, there's lots of things which, you know, is so similar to the Taliban in your husband. So which is similar to Margaret Thatcher in your wife. But you don't look at those, you bow to the other part of them, which you can respect. And that's actually how to create harmony in this world. You know, respect what's worthy of respect. Puja cha puja niyana, eta mangala mutama, from the Mangala Sutta. People sometimes complain, this is the Sri Lankans, why don't you actually mention some Pali in your talks? So I do that every now and again, just to impress you. That's from the Mangala Sutta. To worship that which is worthy of worship is a great blessing. And that's what we're actually doing. So when you go home this evening, look at your husband, find something in him. It may be a bit harsh at first, but you look at him, you'll find something to worship in him and respect. Look at your wife. Look at your mother-in-law. There's always something in there you can find to worship. When you do, you create harmony and tolerance. It's amazing. Or just basically in life. Can you bow to life with its cancers, with its premature deaths and suicides, with its people cheating you, with its stupid governments always arguing, with its wars and train crashes? Can you bow to life? Sometimes people get really depressed and angry. But you can always find something beautiful in there. Worthy of bowing to. And that's actually how we can have tolerance and harmony even to this world, which is sometimes going to be very painful and very dark and hopeless. We can always find something there. Like I can find something to bow to in the statue of Jesus. You can always, even the darkest moments of your life, you'll find something to bow to, something to worship, something which makes his life worthwhile. So you can be at peace with it and carry on learning and growing. Thank you for listening. Okay, any questions before we finish off to go on to do a few questions first of all, for lunch? Okay, any questions, complaints, comments? Now it's going to be a long time before I come back here again. So if you don't ask a question now, you're stuck for another 20 months. For the next day or something. Any questions about what I said? Does it make sense? Does everything make sense?
Yeah.
Really? It's impossible. It must be something that don't make sense. Questions about this or something else? How many of you heard what happened in Bodh Gaya like a couple of weeks ago? What do you think we should do about it? Start a jihad? Fight back? Revenge? Blow up somebody else?
No.
Of course not. I was in Singapore when that happened, and I mentioned one of, again, that story which you've all heard before, the difference between the container and the contents. Remember that? You can blow up as many Buddha statues as you like. You can blow up as many temples, burn them down, kill the monks and nuns, take all the Buddhist scriptures, flush them down the toilet. Those are containers. But we're never going to let the contents be destroyed. And what does that statue, what are those books, what does those monks and nuns teach? They're teaching you peace, forgiveness, let it go. It's amazing, because when you let things go like that, if they go and burn down your temple, you forgive them. And you don't waste your time seeking revenge. You waste your time, don't waste your time, you spend your time raising funds and rebuilding it. That's the Buddhist way. No revenge, it's wasting time. And that means that, yeah, they can blow up the temples, they never blow up Buddhism. It's never destroyed. If you get angry and seek revenge, then you're flushing Buddhism down the toilet. That's offensive. So that's the same with people who abuse you. They may give you a hard time. If you get angry back, especially if you get violent back, you are blowing up Buddhism. You are destroying this sacred religion. And please, I know that we're talking in the car coming here yesterday afternoon. I know in Burma there was problems, but they're solving those problems. Are the problems being solved in Sri Lanka? With, what's it, Buddha Sena? Buddhist army or something in Sri Lanka? An organization? Please don't support such things. Let's destroy Buddhism. It's not protecting it. You see any monks who are just banging down doors of mosques or burning them. That's against the law. That's not Buddhism at all. That's not a Buddhist monk. Quite frankly, they should be put in jail, like everyone else, if you destroy people's property. So please, you Sri Lankans here, you please preserve the Dhamma in your land. Just because you're a monk, it does not mean you're immune to persecution for doing bad things. So that's the only way we can preserve our religion. So, and it is okay. I know in Thailand, people have this weird idea. You're not allowed to criticize a monk or a nun. If you do, it's bad karma. Please remember, you can ask Bante Jack, you can ask all the other Venerable Pekka, all the other monks and nuns. You find all the rules which we have are all because you complained to the Buddha. You know, this monk was doing this wrong, they were doing that wrong. It's our tradition. Without your feedback, you know, we wouldn't have such a good group of monks and nuns. So please give that feedback in Sri Lanka as well. It's important you do that. Don't just let Buddhism be destroyed. Well, peace, kindness, forgiveness, that's most important. Any questions? My question, yes, let's go somewhere. Good.
We talked a lot about karma today. Does that mean that everyone born can be the predetermined life and destiny to some degree, or large degree?
Aha!
Because I know lots of parents, sort of try to pick a good day for the baby to born. And even with ourselves, we always say, oh, you're born a bad day. So I was born one of those days. I always worried, oh, something's going to happen in my heart.
Okay, is it because you have bad karma in the past?
Are we doing proceedings now, but not going to change this life, but it's for next life?
Okay. Now, the simile, the best one I've come up with ever, is the two people baking a cake. Simile. And actually, this came to light again because I saw when I was, and I read the newspapers when I go travelling, because there's nothing else to do in those aircraft. And when I was reading the newspapers, the Straits Times, Singapore, I think Jamie Oliver was in Singapore, and they arranged a contest between Jamie Oliver and streetwalkers to do some cooking, and they got some people from the audience, they didn't know who cooked what, to test out who was the best cook, who made the most delicious food. And Jamie Oliver is a celebrity chef. The streetwalkers won. They were judged to make the more delicious food than the celebrity chef. And that really proves the point of the story about two women baking a cake. The first woman had the very best ingredients you could possibly imagine. Organically grown whole wheat flour, grown in a field 1,000 miles from GM crops. And they had canola oil, which is supposed to be cholesterol free. They had beautiful honey, just from outside Melbourne, the best you can possibly get. And they had fresh fruit from Western Australia. I've got to promote my state as well. With the very best ingredients. And the second woman had the worst ingredients. They had white flour, which had been refined so much that the container, the paper, probably had more good in it than the flour. And they had white, diabetically enhanced sugar, cholesterol enhanced butter, enriched butter, sorry, and they had really hard old fruit. And two people baking the cake. And the question is, who bakes the best cake? It's not always the one with the best ingredients. And sometimes it's not the ingredients you have, but what you put into your baking. And that's like Jamie Oliver, best ingredients, famous chef, But you know, he's got no real competition. Those street hawkers in Singapore, you know, the competition is so fierce, so cutthroat, they really have to lift their game to make even a small profit. So their effort, their energy, their skill, their love is so much greater with what they have to use. It's the same in any place in this world, whether it's in Penang or whether it's in Colombo, you probably get more delicious food from the street hawkers than you do in a five-star hotel. Why? It's not the ingredients, it's what you make of those ingredients. You can be a Paris Hilton and be in rehab, a Lindsay Lohan, with incredible good karma from the past, and make a total mess of your life. Or you can be like a Nelson Mandela, 26 years in jail. Just make incredible cake out of terrible ingredients. So this is karma for you. Yeah, the law of karma is there. The ingredients you have to use in this life come from your past. But how you put them together is the karma of this life. And that's the most important. And you've seen this, I've seen this. People with great good karma from the past, they waste it. And people with terrible karma from the past, they put it together, they make amazing stuff. It brings tears to my eyes when you hear about what some people have been through. And there's mentally disabled, physically disabled, scarred from their early childhood. What they do with those terrible ingredients, they put them together, my goodness, they make such inspiring examples of what can be done for human life. And those are the ones which are inspirational. Have you seen that? It's on YouTube. There's this fellow with no limbs. You seen it on a... He gives a talk on a table and he gets himself up with a mobile phone or something. That's inspirational. There's a guy with no arms, no legs at all. And you see he's got an incredibly bright, beautiful mind. He inspires people. So yeah, he's got some bad karma being having no limbs. But you know, just what he makes of that is inspirational. And those are the sorts of things which teach you about the law of karma. So, okay, you've been divorced. You've had cancer. You've lost your job. You know, you just had some terrible disease. Yeah, but what are you doing about that? It's a tough thing for me to say that to people, but in the end I just get right down to it. Yeah, you're not going to get sympathy, you're going to get encouragement from a mark like me. Get out there and make something of it. Get baking. And you can make incredible cake. And I've seen that too many times to doubt it. That's a lot of karma. Yes?
I don't mean to offend you.
Yes,
I want the door to say something. I want, can you put yourself on sale? What
yes.
happens now?
What happens
and now? When this thing happened, I felt very confused and disturbed.
Yeah.
I felt that you are still in the currency world
yes,
instead
yes.
of in the spiritual world.
Yes,
please
yes,
comment.
Right. I saw myself. Okay. So you all know that we have, I started this Bhikkhuni thing in Australia, doing the first ordination. About that was in October 2009.
Yes.
And so that we have nuns, right? Got to make sure we've got a place to stay. It's become so popular as it's coming here. Monasteries are growing over here. We need them. So I've got to raise funds for my nuns' monastery in Australia. We have a project that you don't have to worry because we're almost there. $3.5 million is the price tag of these buildings. Land is pretty cheap, but buildings cost an arm and a leg and a lot more here in Australia. So we're thinking, let's auction some things. Because I think 2 years ago, 3 years ago, we auctioned my meditation cushion in Hong Kong. And it got in. They auctioned it off for $34,000, my meditation cushion. I couldn't believe it. You know, just because it was enhanced with the power. I've been sitting on that for about 20 years. The power in there. So now whenever I leave Perth, I always lock my cushion in the safe.
Let it go.
So we were thinking, what else can we auction? So we auction your robe, your bag, your phone. Oh, I need my bowls to eat. You're not going to be auctioning me. That's a good idea. So what it was, I really do Now, this is no joke. I've had to get more invitations to teach than I could ever, than 10 of me could ever sort of accept. So I thought, well, you know, why not? Sort of, if people really, really, really want me, they can actually give some money to our nurse monastery. So I auctioned myself off. The highest bidder gets me 7 days anywhere in the world. The proviso is that you've got to return me in the same condition you received me. And it was a bit of fun, which is wonderful, just, you know, making Buddhism more fun, quirky, you know, because no one's done that before. It was really good publicity. So a lot of people worldwide, you know, said, "See, Ajahn Brahm for sale." And when they found out that it was basically advertising the fundraising for our nuns monastery. You know how much we received for Ajahn Brahm for sale? $255,000. It's amazing. Yeah, it wasn't the main donor was 127, but a couple of others said, "Well, we didn't remember we could give you the money anyway." So I mean, that's incredible. And that was just getting people's generosity going. You know what it is sometimes, though, to support the monasteries here. Yeah, you need the funds, but sometimes, oh, no, we can't really afford it. It gets interesting and a bit of fun. It's amazing just how much more energy and how much donations actually come in.
Yeah, brother. If you keep going on money, then you are going on the funds and money.
Well, no, it's fun. Fundraising.
It will never stop.
Fundraising.
Fundraising.
Exactly. Fundraising. It's giving people the opportunity to make good karma.
But in Sangha gets involved so much of money. Fundraising.
Yes.
Yeah.
We don't do that. So what we really do is, you know, we try and encourage you to make good karma. Our main job. Look, there are monks like that. We really get involved. Yeah. There was even, I was in Thailand recently, and they were all talking about this Lumpur Neng Kham, who's got private aircraft, who's got, I don't know how many sort of private sports cars. And that is wrong. If any of the monks do raise money, it's never for themselves. This is me. This is what I use. And many people say, "Ajahn Brahm, can I give you a new one?" No. We're supposed to have rag robes. That's our tradition. So we live very, very simply.
Yes.
And that's really important. Go and check. Ask to go into Bhante Jai's room, see what he's got in there. So go through his bag, see if he's got any Rolexes in there. We don't do that. But what we do, and what's really important to do, is to encourage your generosity, especially to good projects. And again, this is not for monks, it's not for nuns, it's for Sangha, for monastery. So this is another important thing. Please do not give any money to a monk or to a nun. To a society, this is BSV. So any funds you give for that, all the funds for Ajahn Brahm for sale goes to the Buddhist Society of West Australia, who looks after our nuns and monastery and everything else. And it's all audited, so you see where the funds go to. Which is really important. But our job is actually to encourage you to do dana, sila, samadhi, anya. That's our job to do that, encourage you. Without forcing you. Make it fundraising. Not fundraising.
Yeah, I just don't want to get it wrong with
you. Yeah, indeed, yeah. But I'm sold now, so sorry you missed out. You have to wait for the next lifetime.
Yeah.
Yeah, go on.
Where was the 7 days involved?
It was amazing. I said, anywhere in the world. You know where this guy is taking me? To Bhutan.
Oh.
7 days to Bhutan. It's really good. So someone is saying, can you please auction me too? It's a very kind of Indonesian man. And you know, it was just an excuse, you know, to give a donation to the nuns monastery. Because he thought it's a very good thing to do. He wants to see it happen, as many people do. And he thought, well, Ajahn Brahm, I want to give you a bit of a rest. Maybe it's sort of a holiday, but not really a tourist holiday, to go to a Buddhist country and visit some of the Buddhist monks and nuns over there. It's a very, very wonderful thing to do. That's where I've ended up. But it's supposed to be taken. I was a bit concerned because part of the trip was to go and hike up to Eagle's Nest Monastery. And I told him, hang on, you know, you're supposed to return me in the same shape. Please don't kill me. Especially my age and weight. But he said, no, it's only a couple of hours walk. So that gave me great relief.
You get a horse halfway,
Ajahn. Oh, is that kind of
Yeah.
Monks
get on a horse to go halfway.
So monks aren't allowed to use a horse, especially fat monks like me. I'm not compassionate. I couldn't do that to a horse. I feel so guilty. Elephant maybe, but not a horse. Very good. Okay, I think it's 10:15 now, so get ready for our class. So thanks again for listening. I hope I entertained you, but also not just entertained, some nice Dhamma teachings as well. And so hopefully that all got you interested. And again, please support the... I don't mind. It's really easy for me to raise funds for other people's monasteries. I can't really do it for my own. But other people's monasteries, so please help out. Great monastery project happening. So was it Augustine? Was it the 10th or something?
That's the
fundraiser. Yeah. You can't make it with you.
And there'll be a report on the project this afternoon.
Okay, excellent. Very good. Okay, so wish you all happiness and well-being. And see if you can make it so when you die, you've got just the last bit of money disappears. Isn't that wonderful? That's the best. Just go see a fortune teller or some horoscope. Find out when you're going to die. Just before that, the last day, totally no money there. Okay, very good. So, do a blessing or something?
Up to you, Mother.
What do you usually do again?
We usually do it at the meeting, so it's okay.
Okay, we do it at lunchtime then. Give a blessing at lunch. Okay, see you at lunchtime. Happy lunch.
Sadhu.